From WBUR Boston, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Many states, eager for new revenue and not ready to raise taxes, are hoping new casinos might bring in a windfall. Florida, New York, Illinois, Michigan, Massachusetts, they all want to get in the game. But while states are hungry to begin construction, the more states jump on the bandwagon, the smaller the take for each one. This hour, On Point, the big bet on casinos. You can join the conversation. Are casinos slated for your area? Do you drive out of the state to gamble? Wish you could stay closer to home? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Vin Narayanan. He's managing editor of Casino City Times. And with me from Charleston, South Carolina, is Douglas Walker, professor of economics at the College of Charleston. He's the author of The Economics of Casino Gambling. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you for joining us on On Point.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Vin, let me first start with you to sort of set the lay of the land in terms of what's happening, what states are moving, and how promising is that movement for them?
Yeah, I mean, there are a fair amount of states moving. Massachusetts has authorized the building of three casinos there. You've got new casinos moving into Ohio. You have Michigan considering at least one new casino, an Indian casino in Lansing, Michigan. And there's a possible ballot proposal coming up where they might have as many as eight new casinos put on the ballot. And so they're collecting signatures for that. Florida wants to build a new casino in Miami. They screwed it up this year. They tried to make it an all-encompassing gambling bill, and that died in the Florida legislature. But that'll come back next year, and you'll probably see a resort in South Florida or a couple resorts in South Florida. So you've got a variety of new places. Maine is considering building new casinos. So you have a variety of states doing it. Illinois wants to build new casinos. They want to build a casino in downtown Chicago, so you've got that coming as well. So there are a variety of states that want to build casinos, but they're all in the planning stages right now. For example, the Massachusetts casinos, even though they've been authorized, you won't see them till 2015, 2016.
Douglas Walker, Vin was describing the array of states that are looking at moving in this area. Does it make economic sense for them?
Well, that's a good question, and it's kind of a complicated answer. Earlier in the early 90s, it used to be the case that if you introduced casinos early, you could attract tourists. And now I think what's going on is states are more interested in trying to keep their people that are going out of state at home. And so you're less likely now to be getting tourists from out of state, but you're more likely to keep your own people at home and keep the tax dollars there. So I think that's kind of what's going on.
Well, so on net, does that produce a significant gain for one state at the cost of another? Is it a zero-sum game?
Well, it depends on whether you think the number of gamblers is fixed and the total amount of money that they're going to spend is fixed. And
do you?
I don't think we know enough about that yet.
Well, Atlantic City is the classic test case right now. If you want to take a look at cannibalization arguments, in 2006, they were a $5 billion gaming market. In 2010, they were down to about a $3.5 billion gaming market. And that's due to increased competition from Pennsylvania, from Delaware, from the tribes in Connecticut, and from casinos in New York. So if you're talking about cannibalization, on the one hand, there's been a significant impact on the Atlantic City market. But on the other hand, overall gambling, when you take all of those markets involved, it's actually increased. So if you take Pennsylvania and New Jersey, that right now combined is an over $6 billion gaming market, whereas in 2006, it was just a $5 billion gaming market. So it all depends on how you view the numbers.
Why do we call it gaming rather than gambling?
That's the industry jargon. I think when the gambling industry was pursuing casinos throughout the country, they made a conscious decision to call it gaming because gaming sounds a lot better than gambling from a public policy standpoint. And that's what they went with. And the press and pretty much everyone in the industry has picked up and followed from there.
Douglas, I wanted to ask you about that point because I began my career in journalism in the state of Florida, and there was an initiative to permit casino gambling in the state, and a governor, Reuben Askew, successful Democratic governor, as a moral crusade against it, launched a statewide campaign to defeat that proposal. He succeeded. Are those days gone? Are the concerns that some politicians and a significant chunk of the voters once had about the morality of this industry, have those been washed away by economic hard times?
I think they probably have. Again, in the early 90s, those arguments could be made fairly well because casinos had not spread much outside of Atlantic City and Nevada. But now I think with fiscal crises in states and the recession, in both cases where we've seen a quick increase in the number of states offering casinos, the early 90s, and then now we're kind of trying to rebound from a recession. So I think that those issues kind of more than offset whatever moral concerns people tend to have. And since I think gambling is, the access to it now is so easy, there are still a few states that are not considering it, but you pretty much have to admit that your people have access to gambling whether or not you like it. And so the issue now is, should we try to get some of those revenues and other potential benefits or just let them go out of state? But I think, yeah, the kind of moral opposition is kind of a lost cause at this point.
Well, Vin, related to the moral opposition, there has been the argument made over the years that the gambling industry was preying on people who couldn't afford to lose money, that there were associated social costs to gambling. What do we know about the extent to which those fears were proven true or proven not true?
Yeah, problem gambling is a tough issue. The National Council of Problem Gambling, and they're sort of the best trackers of this information, they've actually come full circle, sort of 180 degrees is the right way to put it, in terms of where they viewed it before. Before, they were vehemently opposed to the expansion of gambling. They thought it was going to absolutely increase the incidence of the problem gambling. What seems to have happened is, as a percentage nationwide, the amount of problem gambling has remained about the same. And so there hasn't been a dramatic increase in that, but what the National Council probably—
Any other effects, crime, prostitution, things that sometimes have been associated with the industry?
Not really. There will always be incidences of crime, an increase in crime in communities that weren't as big as they used to be. And so you've had that issue go up where you've had overall crime numbers. But as overall crime numbers across the country have dipped, they've dipped in gambling areas just as they've dipped in the rest of the country. But the interesting thing about the National Council of Problem Gambling is they've shifted from trying to stop the expansion of gambling to asking for money to treat problem gambling. So that they actually want gambling in a regulated environment now where it's out in the open. They feel problem gambling is a lot easier to treat and deal with if the casinos are public, regulated, and monitored than if they're underground.
Douglas, what does the track record tell us about the ability of states in this new fiscal environment, which is very challenging, to actually make casinos and gambling a foundation stone of their state budgets?
It used to be, prior to this past recession, everyone thought that the industry was kind of recession-proof and that it would provide stable revenues for states, but that's been shown not to be the case. And so you do face the issue now where, again, as more states introduce casinos, we don't really know yet what the effect is going to be on the overall stability of the casino revenues. So states are going to continue to get revenues, but I don't think they're going to be as stable and predictable as maybe they once had thought.
And they're not the answer, I take it, to the fiscal problems that states have more broadly with declining sales tax revenue and all the other things that fund education and criminal justice and all the things that states do.
Well, I think what the casinos do primarily is that they are a politically easy way to raise revenues. And so rather than trying to increase sales tax rates or income taxes or property taxes, this is politically convenient, where it's a source of revenue that the politicians control. They can set the tax rates. They can determine how many casinos to introduce. And so it's very easy for them to add to the revenues. Now, it turns out that, casino revenues, tax revenues are not a large proportion of overall state budgets in most cases. But still, it's a way of it's maybe easier than raising other taxes or cutting spending. So politically, I think that's the primary motivation for it.
Then, to the degree that the gambling industry creates jobs in states that can either cannibalize from other states or create new customers, what kind of jobs are they? What do they pay?
Yeah, they're service jobs. They're dealers, cocktail waitresses, restaurants, spas. They're not high-paying jobs, and they're jobs that a lot of them rely primarily on tips.
Better than McDonald's, but not Apple.
Yes, exactly. Better than McDonald's, definitely not Apple. And these are people that work hard for a living, and they scramble, and they're service industry jobs. And yes, they're going to make a lot. They're going to make some money, but it's not going to be a lot of money. The bulk of the money is going to go into the ownership. That's where the money to be made is at. I mean, the casino companies are going to make a lot of money. The employees aren't going to make a lot, but you want to know what? You're in an economy right now where you've got all sorts of people struggling to make money, and any increase in jobs, in their viewpoint, is a good one. If you take a look at all the political initiatives to bring new casinos in, the one constant you have is all the union. The service unions are all for it because they know it's more jobs for their members.
Well, clearly what was considered a weak job 10 years ago might be considered pretty delightful to have right now.
Absolutely. At this point, any job's a good job for a lot of people.
Douglas, do you see this as a growth industry for years to come, or do you think we are approaching some natural limit in the size of this industry?
Well, that's a critical question right now, and to be honest, we don't really know that yet. There have not been empirical studies that have looked at that. Now, you mentioned the case of Atlantic City, where it seems obvious that now increases in revenue are coming at the expense of others, but there's not a lot of empirical evidence in markets overall that can answer that for us. But that's a key question as more states consider the introduction of casinos.
Douglas and Vin, hold that thought. We'll be right back in a moment. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
You know I'm through with gambling. Some Jack Stafford can have my room. Some Jack Stafford can have my room. Pretty women might kill me, but gambling won't be my doom.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about states gambling on casinos to bring in more revenue at a time when they need jobs and tax revenue. You can join the conversation. Is there enough demand for the casinos that are planned? Can we reach a saturation point? Are we already there? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Vin Narayanan. He's managing editor of Casino City Times. And with Douglas Walker, professor of economics at the College of Charleston. He's the author of The Economics of Casino Gambling. Let's go to our listeners. We've got Wes calling from Nashville. And Wes, we know that gambling brings in a lot of money, but it also arouses strong emotions. What's your view?
My question is about the economics of it all. Gambling, it seems to me to be rather based upon the random redistribution of wealth as opposed to really the creation of goods or services that add value or add to the total wealth of an economy. And I wonder if this is not inherently going to be self-destructive if this is pursued, and perhaps not a good course to pursue for states on a very pragmatic economic basis. I'd be interested to hear any reactions.
Wes, thanks so much for calling. Douglas, I think this calls for a little casino economics 101.
Sure. Well, I think you should look at casino gambling as a service industry in the sense that it's similar to, say, going to a movie or going to watch a football game. It's an activity that people that go to a casino enjoy doing it. And so just because it's not the production of something tangible doesn't mean that it's not something that's valuable to people. So people enjoy the experience. It's a social activity for a lot of people. So even though physically it seems like you're just moving money around, people enjoy the activity of gambling. And so that's similar to other entertainment industries.
Let's go to Jason. He's calling us from Newport News, Virginia. Jason, welcome to On Point. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi, John. Well, actually, I wanted to point out I'm a student teacher. I teach music. And I've been to Las Vegas twice before in my life, both before I turned 21. I'm in my mid-20s now. And as a musician and an actor, I love the idea of there being casinos possibly being built in my home state. I don't think Virginia has any plans to add any casinos. But I start thinking about the sense of escapism. I heard it called on this show just last week, The Great Recession. And there's this huge draw for needing escapism. But do you really think Las Vegas will just in Nevada, the state of Nevada, would just sit there and roll over while other states build casinos. Because I kind of imagine them ramping up their advertising and bringing in more gamblers from out of state. I mean, I could have always have gone to Atlantic City growing up, but I would still much rather go to Las Vegas.
Jason, thanks so much for your call. Vin, what about it? You've seen The Hangover. Is Las Vegas still king?
Las Vegas is still king, and the reason Las Vegas is still king is they recognize this trend coming years away, and what they've done is they've diversified. Now only 50% of their revenue comes from gaming revenue. The other 50% comes from entertainment, restaurants, spas, clubs. Right now, nightclubs on a weekend in Las Vegas make more money per square foot than the gaming floor does. And that's a relatively new trend. And so they understand what's going on. They understand that gaming is all across the country now, so they've recast themselves as a resort and a destination town.
And so despite the terrible toll that the housing crisis took on the state of Nevada, is gaming and gambling in Las Vegas now an engine for recovery in that state? Is the state doing well?
Absolutely. It's the dominant industry in Nevada. In fact, this year, the numbers are looking really good. It's been the best numbers in Vegas in the past 2 or 3 years, and they're looking at a bit of a recovery there right now. So they're looking at gaming revenue going up. They're looking at hotel occupancy rates going up. And they had a $1 billion month in January, and they had a strong February despite the fact there was no Chinese New Year to lure in extra gamblers. So they're doing pretty well.
Douglas, let me ask you about another part of the country, the Foxwoods Resort in Connecticut, which to some people stands for the oversaturation, the overextension of this industry. It's struggling badly. What does that tell you about what will happen once Massachusetts gets more fully into the casino business and where states, the exposure that states have once they go down this road?
Yeah, so the Foxwoods presents an interesting case because I think it was built early on in the kind of expansion of gambling across the country. And it's a huge property, obviously. So it was built at a time, and it's been added on to, assuming that there would be a regional monopoly there with it and the Mohegan Sun. And so as casinos become more prominent in Pennsylvania, and if New York legalizes Massachusetts casinos coming on, that property may be too big now for the market up there, given other casinos are going to come in. So I think this is an issue that I would look at as kind of a market issue where, okay, yes, some firms come in, they build too big of a property, that's going to spell problems for them down the road. Now, new entrants into the market in new states are going to be aware of the fact that, you know, there's competition all over the place, there's new casinos likely to come in. And so I think you're likely to see smaller properties. And again, this is an industry where they know what they're doing. They do an enormous amount of study to determine what size casinos they should build, and they do this market analysis. So you can kind of, I think, leave it up to them to change their plans if they think that the saturation issue is becoming a problem, right? A new casino would not want to go into a market that is oversaturated.
Yeah,
I
was going to say at least 25% of Foxwoods traffic's comes from Massachusetts.
Vin, I want to ask you about competition from two different sources and how the industry adjusts to it. One is overseas. We know that Macau, for example, has been very successful in building up its industry. The other is online. And the potential rise of online gaming nationally, what does that pose the same threat to casino operators that online shopping does to brick-and-mortar retailers?
No, it's different because you're operating in a regulated environment. If you were in an unregulated environment, you would see something similar to what you saw with Amazon taking on the big bookstores and killing them and all the activity moving to Amazon and that sort of thing. But you're in a regulated environment where there's a competition for licenses and there's a restriction for licenses. And the brick-and-mortar casinos in the United States are jealously guarding their right to operate these casinos. So if there is online gaming, it's going to be a restricted set of licenses. Right now, it looks like it's going to happen on a state-by-state basis rather than on a federal basis. And so you're going to have local casinos operating online casinos, and there's going to be a synergy between the two. And
do national politicians not want to touch this issue? Do they want to leave it to states and stay out of it?
There are actually two schools of thought. And the on the one hand, they don't want to touch it in an election year. So you can just throw that out the window. But if you take out the election year stuff, you've got Indian casinos who are deathly afraid that this is going to cannibalize their market. And so the politicians from states with big influential Indian tribes, they're standing in opposition to it. Then you've got Nevada, which wants it badly. And the reason Nevada wants it badly is they know online gaming isn't going to cannibalize their existing customer base. It developed a new customer base. The World Series of Poker had 800 participants in the main event. That's their big marquee event, $10,000 buy-in in 2002, 800. And then 4 or 5 years later, thanks to online poker, they were up to 8,000. They saw it grow. And poker rooms were being pulled out of Vegas before. Now poker rooms are being installed in Vegas. And it's because online poker brought a new generation of poker players to the poker world. It used to be 55, 65, 75-year-old men playing the game. Now it's dominated by 22, 23-year-old kids. It's different. And online casino executives get that. So they look at the online gaming world and say, all right, this is how we get the younger generation of gamblers in. So they want them. They're not really worried about cannibalization on that front either.
All right, let's go back to the phone. Susan is calling from Pulteney, Vermont. Susan, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Yes, John. Thank you very much. My question is, I'm 65 years old, so I've been watching this gaming stuff for a while. What happened to the lottery? When they brought in the lotteries, it was the answer to revenues. And I would like to know what is the ratio between administrative costs and their actual revenues?
Thanks, Susan, for that call. Douglas, is there a cannibalization issue there with state lotteries being hurt by gambling? And what is the track record of how much has gone to administration and how much has actually been cleared by the state?
Well, on the second question first, I think in general, lotteries, about 50% of it goes back to the people who are buying tickets. I think probably less than 10% is administrative, and so somewhere around 40% ends up being tax revenue for the states. In the empirical work that's been done on the issue, the casinos and lotteries do negatively affect each other, although it's unclear the extent to the effect. I think it probably depends on the state. So casinos introduced will have a negative impact on lotteries. In terms of the overall revenues from gambling activities overall, though, I think that it probably increases when you have both of those.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We've got Peter from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Peter, thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi, John. I work at a tribal casino in Milwaukee. My wife and I both have been working there for over 5 years. We work in table games. She works in food and beverage and bartending. It's fantastic to have a place that has a good job. They do treat us very well there. Everything is going good. But at the other aspect of the line, my mother was an addicted gambler, chronic slot machines. She would go in and she would be very easily able to spend a large sum of money. And, you know, when she lost her job, it was an aspect of, you know, I'm down and out. I want to go play at the casino. Working there, we see all the different aspects of it. We see the people that have the money that come to play for fun. And then we also see the people that come in with, you know, a couple crumpled dollar bills and try to do the same thing. I mean, it really has a very broad spectrum all the way across the range. Currently, I'm working as a bingo caller there. And so you'll see a whole different clientele. And really, it's an interesting idea of the benefits that are generated for the jobs versus the costs that are involved with just the social costs.
Peter, thanks so much for your call. Vin, mixed bag?
It can be. There's no doubt that there are social costs associated with gambling. But the revenue that gambling brings in tends to so vastly outstrip the social costs that come with it. And I'm not trying to minimize the social costs, because if it's happening to you, it is a serious problem. On the other hand, just in terms of a cost-benefit analysis, if you take a look at the amount of money that the casino brings in versus the amount of money that comes for problem gambling, usually the benefits weigh out on the casino side.
I want to go back to the phones to Peter from Worcester, Massachusetts. Peter, what's your question?
Yes, I have a comment. I believe that gambling per se, in casinos especially, is a zero-sum game. The only profits that are made are the losses of the patrons. And I and the only winners are the house. I think if you really want to talk economics and you want to talk about the well-being of the community, you look for real jobs, real industry, cutting-edge energy jobs, this sort of thing. Educate people. The few jobs that they have in the hotels where they say they're going to have maids and cooks and whatever is insignificant to the amount of money that is pumped in to the revenues of the casino itself. And the community, the people who go to the casinos are the losers. And there is no, you know, they pay taxes. You know, the casinos are going to pay taxes, but if people had incomes, and they would be paying taxes too, and so would the manufacturing jobs. I see this as a complete ruse, and the gambling industry has got its claws in the mind of the public, and they're working it to the best effect. Thank you very much. I'll take my answer. Well, I'll listen to you because my radio is off.
Thanks so much, Peter. Douglas, I mean, you mentioned before that part of the answer to Peter is that people gamble for enjoyment, so the losses should be chalked up to their entertainment. But what about the point that Peter is making about real manufacturing jobs? For some of the communities that are embracing casino gambling, is that really an option for them?
Well, I think if you look at the overall jobs picture, in counties that have casinos, they see a net increase in overall employment. And so if the concern is that the casinos are taking away jobs from other industries, I think the empirical evidence suggests otherwise.
Well, no, but I think isn't the question, could states that are turning to casinos as an alternative pursue manufacturing jobs? Is that an option for them?
Well, it's possible, but with most other forms of manufacture, for example, it's already legal. So the difference is that casinos are illegal, and so if the state legalizes them, then there's an industry that wants to come in. Presumably in Massachusetts, if a factory wants to be someone wants to build a factory, they can already do that. They don't need—
In other words, your thought is that these communities don't have other options. That's why they turn to casinos.
Correct. Why wouldn't other forms of manufacture already be opening up if there was an incentive for them to do that already?
Vin, what does the industry say about that zero-sum game argument?
Well, it's not necessarily a zero-sum game. Casinos and manufacturing aren't mutually exclusive. It's not like you can only do one. You can do both. And the other aspect of it is if you take a look at Fox with the Mohegan Sons, so many of the people there that are working right now used to be working manufacturing. When the manufacturing plants went away in Connecticut and some of the jobs building ships and boats disappeared, they all ended up working for the casino, not because they didn't want a manufacturing job, but the manufacturing job disappeared.
Douglas, to what degree do you think the new geographic ground is going to be broken? That is, we know the Gulf Coast has been a place. We know the Mid-Atlantic has been a growth area. What about areas of the Plain States? What about other parts of the West that have not seen this flower to a considerable degree so far?
Well, I think the concern in the West is that the closer you are to Nevada, the more you're going to have to compete with Las Vegas, where in the Northeast or in the South, you can really create different markets there, and people might be willing to go there as opposed to Vegas. But if you're looking at Idaho or Utah, since Las Vegas is nearby, it's going to be tougher to compete for those types of states, I think.
Douglas Walker from the College of Charleston, thanks so much for being with us. Vin Narayanan, stick around. We're discussing big plans for new casinos and if it's a good bet for cash-strapped states. You can join the conversation. Is there enough demand for new casinos? Will casinos even be relevant if states go with online gambling? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Nobody really knows. It was late one evening during a poker game. A man lost all his money, said Willie was to blame. He shot poor Willie through the head, which was a tragic fate. And Willie's cards fell on the floor, they were aces backed with eights. And it's ride, Willie, ride, roll, Willie, roll. Wherever you're gambling now, nobody really knows. So all you roving gamblers, wherever you might be, the moral of the story is very plain to see. Make your money while you can before you have to stop.
For when you pull that dead man's hand, your gambling days are up, and it's ride, Willie, ride. Roll, Willie, roll. Wherever you're gambling now, nobody really knows.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the rush to build new casinos all across this country. You can join the conversation. Have you joined the fight? Are you against casinos coming to your area? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Vin Narayan and managing editor of the Casino City Times. And now it's time for what I consider the good news part of this story. Joining us now from Bensalem, Pennsylvania, is Don Johnson. He's considered one of the most successful gamblers today. In one night last April, he won nearly $6 million. And as a result of that, he's no longer welcome in many casinos because of his ability to beat the house. Don Johnson, on behalf of losing gamblers everywhere, congratulations.
Thank you.
Tell me what it's been like for you in the year since you have gained fame as the LeBron James of blackjack.
I don't really think a lot's changed. I still handle my real profession, which is in the horse racing industry, which I've worked in for years. So I wouldn't say that a lot has changed at all. It was there was an opportunity to do something with the blackjack at that time, and that window of opportunity opened and it closed again.
So for you, gambling, blackjack in particular, is a hobby, something that you've got a day job, and this is entertainment for you every weekend, every once in a while?
Well,
or much more constantly than that?
Yeah, I think you have to classify things differently. I mean, look, I don't win every time I walk into a casino, but I'd like to think of it more like there are different things that the casinos offer to different levels of different types of players. And when they're offering those things, look, they've calculated somewhere in their numbers that they still have an edge over the player. So in their calculation, they're saying they still have an edge over you. I'm looking at it saying if they're giving these things away to other players, and I want to get all that I can get, knowing that the deck is still stacked against you slightly.
Talk a little bit about what some of those advantages are, because in reading about your case, I had been unaware of exactly what you just described. That is, people who were, especially in weak economic times, people who are big players, who the casinos want to bring in, and that they will sometimes tweak the rules of the game to attract those players. So what did, let's say, in the with your huge breakthrough last April, what were the ways in which the casinos made it more attractive for you to play?
Well, I'll just give you some obvious differences. They may or may not apply in New Jersey or Las Vegas. In general, if you look at the game of blackjack, there's a big difference between sitting down at a double-deck game of blackjack that pays even money or 6-5 or one that pays 3-2. You want to get the full 3-2, meaning 1.5-1. You don't want to take less than that just because they shorten the number of decks that they're dealing from. You want them to stand on soft 17. You want to be able to surrender. You'd love to have early surrender that gives you even more of an advantage. And there are a number of other things that have to happen. The discount policy, if you do happen to suffer a loss, you want to get a 20% discount on your losses. You want to try and get that game as close to an even game as possible, like flipping a coin.
And that's what you did before that breakthrough?
Yeah, a lot of it was negotiating before walking in. And as I said, look, a lot of those doors are closed now. They're not going to offer that the same type of a game.
Right. Anymore. Well, talk about what it was like that night. That must have been an incredibly thrilling experience on many levels for you. Were you feeling like the basketball player who couldn't miss, or talk about what it was like to play?
No, I didn't feel like a basketball player that couldn't miss, but it was a good run of luck that lasted through an entire evening. And when they're letting you bet that big, they're gonna take a big hit. And it comes down to if you hit your splits and doubles, the rest of it is pushing back and forth. You're going to wind up a considerable amount in front of them. But I still would have to reiterate, look, it's not like walking up to an ATM machine, punching in a code, and you just take money out every time. During the entire course.
If it were, I'd be doing it myself.
Well, exactly. I mean, look, you're winning and losing all the time, And if the game is pretty much 50, if you can get as close to a 50-50 game as possible, you're generally going to be up that discount that they were offering.
Vin, let me
add. Not offering the discount anymore, the game becomes a lot more difficult.
Vin, let me ask you about Don's story. I assume the Casino City Times was covering Don Johnson's story. Were you thinking that you were covering something historic at that time? Talk about how exciting that was as a journalist.
As a journalist, it was fun covering it. I didn't think it was necessarily historic in the sense that someone took the casino for a lot of money. I thought it was historic in the sense that one player single-handedly wrecked the revenue of a casino. If you take a look at like the Tropicana in Atlantic City, he was the difference between profitability and not profitability that month he had the big winning. To me, that was significantly more interesting. The other thing,
How often does that happen?
It doesn't happen that often. There are big gamblers all over the country, and the casinos, and I think this is the thing people have to know, casinos are really sophisticated operations. They know how much money they're making down to a square foot. They know how much money they can make off of every player based on how they play, based on their playing patterns. They know what promotions get people into casinos and out of casinos. They know everything. And they're really sophisticated marketing operations and really sophisticated entertainment operations. And so you don't walk into a casino thinking that you're going to beat them. What you do is you have to do what Don did, which is give yourself the best possible chance to win some money. And that's what he did. If you play expert blackjack, and this doesn't involve counting cards or anything like that.
Why doesn't it involve counting cards? I've heard that there's a prohibition on that, but wouldn't anybody
there's no prohibition to counting cards. And it's not going to get you all the way there anyway.
Yeah.
I said this before, you know, monkeys can count cards. It's like counting bananas.
But I was reading a story about your success, and there was a comment from a casino executive saying, well, card counting is not allowed, and they try to see if you're counting cards. I don't really understand that. Isn't that what anyone does when they're playing cards, is try to figure out what the odds are, that the probability is that the next card's going to be
that's kind of that's the joke, right, or the rub, whichever way you want to look at it. You are counting. You're counting to 21, and you hope you don't go over, right?
Yes. That's exactly what you're doing. What counting cards does is...
Exactly. But what they don't want you to do is track a variance in the cards. You know, are there more 10s left in the unseen portion of the cards relative to 2s through 6s, 7, 8s, and 9s are neutral? They don't want you tracking variances that might change the odds of the game, where it might try to favor itself more in favor of the player, and you're increasing your stakes.
I mean, what the casino?
Why is that not legitimate, though, for a player to try to figure out which cards have been played and which ones haven't?
Well, you should be able to.
You should be able to. Casinos don't like it when they lose, and they've stacked the rules in their favor. And this is part of why players, to a certain degree, like going to casinos to be entertained. But on the other hand, they don't like casinos because the casino's trying to stack the rule in their favor. I've had this conversation before with several people. If a dealer gives you $20 when you're only supposed to get $10, are you going to say something? In casinos, everyone says no. But if a cashier does that at the grocery store, you're going to say yes. You'll say something to the cashier, you gave me too much money back. And the reason is because casinos try to stack the rules so heavily in their favor, people feel like it's okay to not say something when the casino gives you that extra money. But what Don was doing, and at least my understanding, Don, is you're just playing perfect strategy with rules in your favor. I mean, that's what I try to do when I go to a blackjack table, is I play blackjack for fun. Now, I don't play the stakes Don does. I don't get the rules that Don does because I'm playing at $10 tables. But I know what perfect strategy is. I know what to do in every situation, and I play the cards, and sometimes I win some money. Sometimes I lose some money. But when I'm playing perfect strategy, the house edge isn't that high. It's less than 1%. What Don did was he took it from less than 1% to almost a coin flip, and then he hit him for a lot of money.
Don, let me ask you, since your success, and you, as Vin said, you made the difference between profit and loss for that casino for a period of time. How do big casinos treat you now?
A lot of them don't want me. You know, I don't want to get into specifics and names. Look, it's their prerogative in some states, like Nevada. They don't have to allow you to come and
play.
Or
Or is it that they say, we still love you, Don, but we want you on different terms, or we want you on a different set of rules?
Exactly. If I were running a casino and somebody said that they were a card counter, look, I would happily operate the casino and invite all card counters to come in. I would just change the rules. I'd tweak them back in my favor so that I don't have to lose to this person on a regular basis. I mean, ultimately, if the guy, what else could they be doing? I mean, ultimately, if somebody is tracking a variance and their bet swings are too far from zero to whatever they're letting you play, then maybe you got to narrow that gap a little bit. I don't know what they're factoring into their casino edge. Not really sure how they do that. What they're willing to give up in order to get certain players to come in that are volume players.
So, from your standpoint, have the concessions stopped coming?
For the most part, yes.
Vin, talk about how important...
And the ones that are offering things, it's with no discounts. You got to play them straight up. The game may be slightly the same. So, you know, now here's a situation where you'd have to shift and play a different type of the game. And, I'm not really into sitting there playing a grind game when that's really not my main business. I'm not in the business of trying to go to a casino and lose. Everybody wants to go and win.
Right.
And that's why you go.
Don,
you got to separate whether or not it's a recreational player, whether or not it's a high-end professional player, or somewhere in between.
Don, talk a little bit about where this expertise of yours came from. When did you start playing cards? When did this the idea of gambling first catch your imagination?
Well, I've been around it my entire life. I've been around horse racing my entire life. I think from understanding the business of horse racing and how those markets work relative to the fees that are taken out of them, they emulate a lot what happens on the stock market. I think the casino operates under the same premise. The difference in a parimutuel pool is that the house is the custodian of the pool, and people are actually trading and playing against each other in that pool, where it's kind of the same, where if I'm operating a casino, I want enough of big players, small players, medium-sized players to balance out my portfolio of clients that are coming in so that, I'm the custodian and I'm just kind of trading the transactions, but I take my goal should be is to take a little bit out of everybody that's coming through the door. You follow me? So you're going to have players that are winning and losing and winning and losing. It's just if you start offering wagers that are too high on a single wager, you're now going to have big swings as a house.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We've got Bill calling from Louisville, Kentucky, which is a center of the horse racing industry. Bill, thanks for calling. What's your question?
Thanks, John. I'm curious if the panel has a view on whether adding slot machines and other forms of gambling to the thoroughbred tracks would be beneficial overall to the thoroughbred industry. There's a lot of interest in that. A lot of people feel both ways about it because of changes in the thoroughbred industry. Does the panel have a view on whether other forms of gambling at the tracks would help the industry?
Vin, let's start with you.
Yeah, they tend to increase race pool sizes. So, I mean, if you're looking for more money to put into the prize pool for horse races, the slot machines definitely do that. But they don't necessarily increase the crossover between your traditional gambler and your horse bettor. They still tend to be two distinct pools of people. And so it's a tricky question. A lot of it comes down to a public policy question. Do you want the gambling industry subsidizing the horse racing industry? Because the horse racing industry is losing a lot of money. And if the answer is yes, then slot machines are a good thing for the horse racing industry. And if the answer is no, then you don't want the gambling industry subsidizing it, and you let the horse racing industry go away.
Don, you're an expert in both of these industries. What's your view?
I think the question and the answer is a lot more complicated, and to simplify would be very difficult because you're weighing a lot of different things in the horse racing industry. For instance, I heard the discussion earlier where you're talking about the pros and cons of having a standalone casino come into your community. I think that's vastly different than having a casino that's at an existing gaming facility like a racetrack. The racetrack, through its association with the agricultural community, creates thousands and thousands of more jobs that go far outside of the racetrack and the gaming operation at the track than does a casino, a standalone casino operation. And if you have a if you have an agricultural industry product there in horse racing and caring for horses and raising them and grain and hay and gasoline and motel and transportation and all the jobs that are created front side and back side, that's a lot different than what you're creating by having a standalone casino. Now, the standalone casino may in itself create a lot more revenue that can be used to help prop up horsemen's purses at the track and maybe prop up some of the revenues for the track operator through the casino side. But I don't think you should look at it as though, are you going to subsidize horse racing? I think that you should look at it more like you're partly cannibalizing horse racing by allowing this other gaming product to come into the market. And if you cannibalize it too much, you're going to kill all those jobs that already existed out there in some places like Kentucky for over 120 years.
Vin, I want to go to you about the success that Don has had. How many people are there like Don who have won very large amounts of money for casinos who would be in that elite group of players?
It's hard to say because the casino—
Hundreds? Dozens?
Hundreds. Yeah, hundreds. It's hard to say because the casinos don't make a business of publicizing what's happened.
It's embarrassing to them?
It is a little embarrassing to them. I mean, casinos want people to win because people winning gets people back in the door. So it's not like they don't want people to win. They just don't want people to win so much that it hurts their bottom line. And what's happened in Vegas, for example, is all the gambling is in private parlors. Your high-stakes gambling happens in private parlors. So you have no idea whether the guys in the private parlors are winning or losing. All of that's done in private. I mean, Don, my understanding of your situation is people could see you winning or losing, and that's sort of how the buzz built around it.
Right, and then that, pieces of it got leaked to the press, and then somebody had put the pieces together and figured out it was one person that beat multiple properties. But getting back, look, yes, I won some money overall, but I didn't just walk into town and walk away with $15 million. There are losses in there, too.
But, Don, it doesn't sound like hitting the jackpot, so to speak, in this one event has diminished any of your interest in continuing to play. It seems like you love it an awful lot.
I enjoyed. I enjoyed on a recreational level, and I enjoyed, trying to figure out the game. I also enjoy the horse racing. So, if I had to choose between the two, I'd choose horse racing every day because I grew up with it. I think it offers a lot more to a community than just a standalone casino.
Don Johnson, thanks so much for being with us. Congratulations, Vin Narayanan. Thank you too. You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.